And this is Focus 580. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking with Peter Carey about his new novel. It is just out. The title is Theft, A Love Story, and it's published by Knopf. He has written 9 novels and a collection of stories. He's won a number of awards for his work. He has twice won the Commonwealth Prize for Best Book, and he has also twice won the Booker Prize for his novels Oscar and Lucinda and for True History of the Kelly Gang. He was born in Australia. He now makes his home in New York City, and he is now spending some time on the road talking about his new book. He is in Boston this morning, and he's joining us by telephone. As we talk, of course, as always, questions are welcome. If you'd like to call in and speak with Peter Carey, you can do that by calling the number here in Champaign-Urbana, which is 333-9455, or if it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Either of those numbers will work, and we'd certainly welcome you into the program. Mr. Carey, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, happy to be here.
I certainly do appreciate it. Well, something that I think that you are certainly known for and very good at in the work that you do is creating distinctive characters that have distinctive voices. And I think that's certainly true in this book, because the main characters here, the storytellers, are two brothers, and they mostly through the book, they alternate chapters talking about what's going on, telling the story, and giving us, in some cases, two different views of the same events. And as this goes, the reader, I think, comes away with the feeling that the truth is somewhere perhaps in between the two stories or some combination of the two. And so perhaps to start, I might ask you to just give us, if you would, a kind of a thumbnail sketch of the two Boone brothers, Michael and Hugh.
Well, right. Well, the first voice you're going to meet in the book is the painter, who's formerly known as Michael Boone, but more familiarly as Butcher Bones. And he and his brother were both come from this little Australian town with a population of about 4,000 people, sort of a working class, lower middle class town. And Butcher somehow has got out of this, and just by sheer will and has arrived in the city and slowly made himself into a painter. Of course, he's carrying the baggage of his past with him. And when we first meet him, he's really down on his luck a little. He has been quite famous, but as happens in the art world, fashions change, and suddenly his auction prices are down, his dealers can't sell his work, he's been through a divorce, he's lost access to his child, and worst of all, he's just been in prison for trying to retrieve his own best paintings, which the court has said are marital assets and therefore belong to his wife. So he's not in good shape at this particular moment. Now, the great burden, and he's a great complainer, I might say, our butcher. And so he also has to look after Hugh. And Hugh's his brother. They're both big, but Hugh is bigger and stronger. And, the sort of role in literature that we think of somebody as an idiot savant, there's something wrong with Hugh. But Hugh also, in his odd, strange language, often gets things very right. And I think the reader will sort of rather come to trust Hugh. Mm-hmm. So not only is he no longer in the city, but he's got to live in the country. Not only has he got no money, but he's got to look after Hugh. And there the pair of them are on this, I think, quite pretty house, but on the banks of what's called the Never Never River. Long way from Sydney.
Mm-hmm. And maybe we should explain that the reason that he gets this nickname Butcher is that his father, their father, was a butcher, and that he was not particularly happy about his son becoming an artist. He, by all rights, I suppose, should have followed in the family business. And in fact, I think about the title of the book, I think that maybe one of the things that holds the characters together is this feeling that that a lot of them have, that something that rightfully should have been theirs was taken from them. So somehow something is really missing in their lives. Something was along the line was stolen from them, and that they're all grieving for some kind of a loss.
That's, you know what, I hadn't put it together in that way, but it works very, very well. And that's true. This happens all the time when you listen to readers tell you what you've done. And certainly, you're particularly right about, you know, Hugh would have loved to have been a butcher.
Mm-hmm.
And the great pain of his life, you know, and to have stayed in that town is that his brother has walked away from all of this and turned his back on the town and the family, and that no one would trust Hugh to be a butcher because he was a little strange.
Yeah. They didn't want to put the knife in Hugh's hand.
Well, I think you think about this family. You know, this is a family where you know, I don't necessarily give huge amounts of detail about family life, but I think that the detail that I give gives you some feeling with the mother at every night sort of locking up all the knives. tells you something about the sort of, you know, the violence that's always sort of hovering in this household.
Well, and you describe the father as being a man, a very angry man, and that so you don't want to trust him with the knives after dark. You don't want to trust Hugh with the knives after dark.
And nobody.
The poor mother is somehow doom is always this cloud that's always hovering over, and you get this feeling that she was someone who felt that if you survived the night, it was some kind of a miracle.
Yes, and she's taken refuge in some sort of rather self-punishing form of Christianity, I think. But all of this sort of sounds miserable. You know, let the author hasten to tell it. I think it's quite a funny book, and that, you know, the humor in a way is, you know, a very strong life force. I was also going to say that the whole thing about, you know, this artist coming from this little town. I'm now 63, so that when I was a young writer, I started to look around the other people who were writers and painters of my age, you know, when I was in my 20s and 30s, and so many of them came from little towns like I had, and were the first persons in their family to have gone off to college, probably came from houses where there were no books and there was no paintings, and it was really so common to meet these figures in Australian literature, and now, of course, many of them are substantial figures. So they have, we do know that sort of journey from the very small working class, lower middle class town, you know, towards the metropolis.
Well, and in fact, you in the book, the brothers come from this place called Bacchus Marsh, and Bacchus Marsh is in fact a real place, and it is where you were born.
I was born there, yeah, and that's. So this has tempted various people to suggest that it's autobiographical, but I say, well, there's biography on the one hand and there's geography on the other, and I'm raiding place rather than, thank God, you know, I didn't come from that butcher shop.
Yeah, well, and there are some other things, and I will not go into the details, but I've read about it certainly that have caused other people to say, yes, this is autobiographical. And I guess the only reason I raise that question is that I'm sure, for people who write fiction, this is something that they have to struggle with constantly. That readers want to say to them, this is about you, right? This is, well, you. This guy,
you know,
is you, isn't it?
You know, David, when I think that the weird thing, and I'm capable of doing this too, so I just can't blame readers as opposed to writers, but I think when fiction really works, it's really hard to believe it's made up, because when it succeeds, you know, by definition, you know, you're in that world and you believe it. And but all of my life, you know, like I wrote a book called Oscar and Lucinda, you know, and everyone was determined that I must be Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
and they wanted to know who was Lucinda.
Yeah, well, that's me too, of course. Same why. you know, in a book called The Tax Inspector, which was set in a motor business, which my family, you know, had a motor business in Bacchus Marsh, but this was a motor business somewhere else. And I really chose that because, you know, I could sort of raid it for detail and the sort of life. But, you know, was I the demented child abuser and abused, and that, but no, God, I hope not. So, you know, I think we really need to sort of remind ourselves in the total magic of literature and fiction, and that these characters like Madame Bovary, you know, exists in our mind really vividly, and she was never born and never walked. Flaubert made her.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Peter Carey, and his new novel, which has been officially out about a week or so, is Theft, A Love Story, and it's published by Knopf. He is the author of a number of others, and all of them, I believe, except the brand new one, are available in paperback. They're published by Vintage. He's won a number of awards for his work, including the Booker Prize, which he won twice for Oscar and Lucinda, and also for True History of the Kelly Gang. He's now out on the road. He's in Boston to talk about the book, and it was good enough to spend some time with us. And questions are welcome here. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. As you explained, one of the two main characters here, of the narrators, Michael Butcher Boone, is a painter, and he has a great time, but I'm sure you probably also have a great time, saying some things about the contemporary art world, mostly about how much it's driven by money. That there are people in a position to make and break careers that often have poor taste and poor judgment, and that, in fact, some people will pay a lot of money for something they don't really understand as long as somebody else says it's good. All of that.
I think that's true, and certainly this drives the painters totally mad, of course. If you're the beneficiary of the market, then I suppose you walk around smiling, but so many painters are not. And I live in New York, and I live in an area where there are lots of quite elderly working painters shuffling along the street with paint stains on their trousers and grim looks on their faces, having to live with this reality. And they're keeping on painting, of course, because that's what they do. But talking to them, they won't be very different in their responses to the market.
Did you end up, and this is something I'm sure I've made this observation before in conversation with some writers, that in fact writers often have to do research. It's not just everything made up out of their heads.
Oh, so, yes.
How much time did you spend trying to learn about art and painting and the business of art?
Well, the first thing, of course, is that what you know, writers read all the time anyway. So, during the period one's working on Theft, Love Story, when I'm writing or working on that, I'm reading a lot about art and all sorts of odd little things, and not necessarily on the period and not necessarily directly relating to it. But so that I'm immersing myself in reading in that way. But then the sort of fun of it was, and really the reason I got into it, is I became friends with a man in New York called Stuart Walter, who had been an assistant to the American painter Kenneth Noland, and then had a career as a painter, and then had become a dealer. And I like him, and he's a spirited, impish sort of a man. And we had lunch together a lot, so I loved his stories. And so at the beginning of my research, when I didn't even know I was doing research, when I was just enjoying myself talking to him, was hearing all of these stories, and of course he's involved in buying and selling paintings now at quite a high level in the market, and he knows lots of painters, and one day it was from him one day that I learned about this particular French law, which is quite an important part of the novel, which is my French is appalling, of course, but the droit moral, mm-hmm. which is the right to declare whether a work is authentic. It's many rights, but one of them is to say that this is a real Picasso, this is not a real Picasso. And that right is inherited. So you don't have to actually know anything or have an eye or have any education to have this particular right. And that seemed to me sort of extraordinary and very interesting for the potentials for funny story.
Yeah. So, well, that I think that is interesting. I certainly didn't know such a thing existed. But just so that people understand, what we're talking about here is that, for example, Picasso could have been your great great grandfather. You never met the man, and yet somehow, simply the fact that you were related to him confers upon you, at least in the view of the government of France, the ability to say this painting that I'm standing in front of is a real Picasso. He did all the work start to finish, and that this painting next to it is, perhaps he made some sketches, he slapped some paint on it, then he put it aside and said, I'm not sure what I'm doing this. Somebody else came along and patched it up and is trying to pass it
absolutely.
off.
Absolutely. And
which actually happened.
Well, let me tell you a little story, if I can do it quickly, without any names, right? But here's the famous Cubist painter, not Picasso. Here's the famous Cubist painter getting on in years. He's married. He's got a terrific studio assistant who's married to a very pretty young woman. The famous painter's wife dies. Soon afterwards, the studio assistant divorces his pretty young wife. Then the pretty young wife seems to marry the famous grand old painter. Then he conveniently dies. She then inherits the Duamaral. She then remarries mm-hmm. the studio assistant. And the pair of them have then got it all sewn up. They're in control of all the works. They can say which is fake or which is proper and which is not. They control the market. They can finish up a few of the paintings that were not completed at the time of the artist's death. They can sign some things that were not signed. They could even do a few of their own. And so that's a lot of power. Then their studio assistant dies, and there she is, and she really doesn't know too much about anything to do with the painting. And so she would immediately assemble around herself a critic who's written about the artist, a couple of dealers who've dealt in the artist's work, and their job then is to buttress her opinions or her statements and to maintain the market. And what I'm telling you is something very, very close to something that happened with a very famous artist.
It actually did. So that it's you have that was perhaps part of your inspiration that
a
led
huge
to
part of it.
Theft.
I mean, I saw the document. Sorry.
I'm just going to say that little story you've told, that's not fiction. That actually happened.
Yeah.
It's a very, very entertaining book. I've certainly enjoyed it, as I have with the other. I think now I've read only four, I must say, four of your novels. And
I can expect more sales from you, David.
I'll see what I can do about that. I'll talk you up. I'll chat you up among all of my friends and say, oh, you definitely must go out and read this man's books because they are very, very entertaining. The new one is Theft, a Love Story. It's just out. It's published by Knopf, and all the others are still available, and they're out in paperback, so bargain prices there. You know, something I was just curious about, I just happened to, as I was looking at the jacket of the book. This is way off the subject, but I guess it does have to do with visual art. And I noticed that it was designed by Chip Kidd, who is probably the only book jacket designer that probably, if anybody has heard of one, this is the one guy that you've heard of, perhaps just because he's gotten a lot of attention for his work, which I think is very good. They're always very interesting. Did you have anything to do with having him do that, or is that all the publisher's deal?
I've got a little bit of a say. If I said I didn't want Chip, then I could have said that, but I think he's very, very, very good. And he's done many of my book designs, and I like him, and I think he's brilliant. Actually, I'll tell you a funny thing about this book jacket, which Sonny Mater, who's the head of Knopf, showed me the design, and I said, oh, I don't like it at all. And I spent about half an hour telling him why I didn't like it. And then he said, well, you should look at it. And then Chip got on the phone to me and said, listen, Sonny and I hardly ever agreed like this. Please like it. So I rang back Sonny and I said, I guess the reason I'm with you guys is that you are the best, and Chip's the best, and you're the best. So I think we should go with this design. Yeah. And then he spent the rest of the time calling me, and he'd say, Michael Andacci was in my office, and he says, it's a terrific design. I say, I don't care about Michael, he's just a writer. But now, see, the book looks terrific in the stores, and everyone loves it, and I was right to listen to them, and it would have been stupid to reject it.
Yeah. Well, I guess despite what we might say, book jackets do in fact sell books, or at least they get people to pick the book up and look at it. We will continue now our conversation with Peter Carey. He's a novelist. He has published 9 novels with a collection of stories. Is actually Theft, was that number 10 or is that number 9?
Oh, I think it's number 9, I think.
Okay. Well, in any case, he has written a number of novels. He's twice won the Booker Prize. First for his book Oscar and Lucinda, that was made into a film, and also a little bit more recently for True History of the Kelly Gang. The books are all available still, and they're all in paperback, except for the brand new one, which is just out now. It's titled Theft, A Love Story, and that's published by Knopf. We mentioned just a little bit that at the beginning that the story here is told by the two brothers, the painter, Michael, and his brother, Hugh. And there is also another major character in the book, a woman that Michael becomes involved with, and she is, quickly this gets very complicated, but she is the wife of the son of a famous painter, someone that not a real painter, but someone that you have made up, but someone who would have been, I guess, a contemporary of Picasso. This man named Jacques Leibovitz. And here you've gone about creating a character and a collection of work, someone who is indeed a fictional character. How did you create Jacques Leibovitz, who actually we never meet in the book because he's dead by the time that the story is
going? We have to create his work and his history.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's scary looking back on it, isn't it? I suppose that, you know, in my mind, I started thinking about Leger, the Cubist painter, and then the needs of my narrative sort of meant that the paintings had to alter a little bit. But there are certain things that I stole from Leger to give to Leibovitz, like, you know, the cones and cylinders that, you know, Leger's work is, you know, often filled with, for instance. But there were things to do with the narrative itself, which meant I had to have, you know, particular subject matter, and then as I wrote about the paintings, they changed into something that is sort of like something I've never quite seen. So that was sort of fun to do, and fun to, you know, be able to do that in a way that I could convince the painters that I knew what I was doing. Because in all of this, the scary thing for a writer is you're going to write about painting. And it's, you know, when I wrote True History of the Kelly Gang, I knew I had to write a book that could be read by people who'd dealt with horses all their lives. And I had to convince them that I knew as much as they did or more. And I'm frightened of horses, it's the truth. Dealing with painting and painters is perhaps easier for me because at least no painting ever tried to kill me. So I did a lot of work, you know, talking to my friend Stuart, talking to other painters and reading a lot, so that I not only had to create the work of Jacques Leibovitz, but I had to create the work of Butcher's paintings as well. Mm-hmm. And do it in such a way that it was, you know, convincing. And then, of course, the thing that's involved in all of this is that, you know, is the thing of the droit moral, which where, you know, Marlene has married the son of the great painter who has inherited the droit moral, who has fought to get it, but does not give a damn about his father's work. And oddly, she will be the one who falls in love with it, and although gets involved in some, let's shall we say, some scuzzy business about mm-hmm. it, one feels truly loves the work.
Well, she, interestingly enough, is someone who, much like the boys, has come from a small town and has made something of herself. She escaped the fate that she might have met if she had stayed where she was, and become a part of a much bigger and wider world, and discovering in the process that with the tutelage of someone who knew about art, had the eye. She's got it. She knows it, and Butcher knows it, and that it's odd that here now she becomes involved. She becomes involved with the son of the great painter who knows nothing about art and couldn't care less. He doesn't have the eye, but she does, and so somehow she by this strange path also ends up inheriting the right to say yes or no, and maybe, and to profit by it, and maybe in fact she was better that she had it than her husband, who just
I think so.
Less.
I mean, one of the curious, there are three sort of strange characters who are obsessed with art in this book, all of whom coming out. There's Marlene, there's Butcher, and there's this strange little policeman, art policeman called Amber Street, who's a rather larcenous little figure himself, not given to sort of picking up the odd bit of art and putting it in his pocket. But all of them are in love with art. All of them came from what I think the book calls us, from outside the castle walls of art. And although they're all imperfect characters, you know, and Marlene frighteningly so, they do also stand in contrast to the sort of the market forces and the people at the auctions for whom it's a business, because these people in their different ways live and breathe and will give all for art. Mm.
This book, I think, is particularly hard on collectors or on all people who are arbiters of tastes, and is very sympathetic to creative artists. And I wonder, we were talking earlier about the fact that one of the things that that Michael rails against is the business of art and how much of it is driven by business and by people who he would say don't have any idea what they're looking at. And there's this phrase that comes up in the book at several points where he says, how can you know how much to pay if you don't know what it's worth? Now, I just wonder if there are some parallels between your experience as a creative artist, as a writer, in the business of publishing. Do you see some parallels between the tirades that he engages in when he's talking about
I think it's tougher for the painters. I mean, you know, there is a parallel. I mean, that line, how do you know how much to pay if you don't know what it's worth, is lifted from my friend Stuart at lunch. And I think I misremembered it or changed it a little bit, but that it comes from someone who is sort of incensed by what's happening at the auctions that week, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, in other words, it's not a sort of but I seized on it, of course. I think the painters perhaps see it more vividly. The writers, of course, literary writers rarely expect to do financially terribly well. It's not been their expectation or even a sense of possibility. But it's also true that we will think, well, so-and-so's a big name now, but, you know, will he or she, you know, last the distance, and, you know, the popularity is perhaps not well earned. And we're all capable of those bitter, jealous little thoughts and so on. But I think it's maybe a little bit different in the world of painting. I don't know.
Hmm. At least the book before this one, I think My Life Was as a Fake was that came between Theft and the Kelly Gang.
Yeah.
Is that right? Right.
Yeah.
That is a book that's about a literary hoax. And I like that book very much. This is a book just to give the tiniest little sketch. It's about a man who creates a fake poet. And it seems to be one of these efforts that, you know, his idea is that he'll create it and he'll fool everybody, including the literary establishment, into thinking, oh, this is a great poet, when the poet doesn't exist. But then he's surprised by one day the fake poet, which he's created, actually comes knocking at his door.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about how one of the reviewers of Theft that I read said that you were a writer who was fascinated by deceit and subterfuge. And I thought, well, okay, I guess I can see that. Do you, in fact, think are those things that fascinate you? And would you say that, yes, and those are themes that run through a lot of the stories that you've written?
You know, I wouldn't have consciously thought that. But when I hear someone say that, I guess it's true. I mean, I don't have a quibble with it, but it isn't the way. The thing that really fascinated me about that notion was it's about the sort of power of the imagination, or it's about magical thinking. You know, it's that thing that you better be careful what you say, or you better be careful what you invent, because it might come true. And yeah, and writers get to thinking like that a little bit, I suppose, because they write things and then years later they see something like something they wrote. And there is a sense that we are the stories we tell. So that's where I was coming from in that. And also, you see, that's based on a historical thing in Australia where these two conservative poets invented a modern poet, a biography and a body of work in order to make, you know, modernism look foolish. But years later, no one reads those two poets, but they read the work of the invented poet that they wrote, mm-hmm. and he really sort of lives. So I began thinking how he really has come to life. So I began writing it. When I began to write the book, I began to write it in the voice of the invented poet, you know, who was born at the age of 24 in the backyard, and you know, no preparation made for his birth because there are two men there who haven't, and he's called a fake from the minute he's born, and he's furious. So I hope that's coherent.
Well, it is for me, but I've read it now. although the and I think the thing that that's really tantalizing about the book, and I suppose this is also part of the point, is I think as a reader, I continued as I was reading the book to ask myself this question: well, does somehow the fake poet actually show up in the flesh, or is this some sort of delusion of the man who has created him? And I suppose that the point of the book is that's a question. I'm not sure that it's ever, to my satisfaction, at least as a reader, was never really resolved, and maybe that's sort of beside the point. But I suppose that does say something about the fact that that a writer's literary creations do take on lives of their own, then that they are often beyond, inasmuch as we think, well, you made the character up, didn't you? Well, yes, but that somehow they do have a life of their own, and they're beyond the control of the person who created them.
Well, they are, because in fact they don't really come to life until the reader's eyes hit the page, and then, you know, and that's the moment when the character really comes to life, when the reader imagines things as a result of the words on the page. And one of the extraordinary things for me, which I've valued and more the older I get, is that, you know, I go into a novel really not thinking about characters at the beginning. I'm thinking about ideas and you know, it's relatively theoretical, or I'm almost like a cartoonist at the beginning. Who would do that? Who would do that? And so in the process of writing a book over 3 years, I find the characters. And I have to going back and saying, is that real? Would somebody really do that? At the end of the book, I've got some characters. And then the very weird thing is, then those characters exist in people's minds. And, you know, they're standing up and they're walking around and they're not like any people I ever knew. And they've got a sort of a reality, and I didn't. And I started off with an idea. So it seems miraculous and quite lovely.
Well, just the other day, I happened to be talking with Walter Mosley, I've spoken with a couple of times. A very, very nice man, and was talking about writing. And one of the things that occurred to me, I was thinking about, well, what is it about characters in books that make them memorable? And I thought, well, you know, there are some times when characters simply seem to exist as to service the plot. And then there are other times when you finish the book and you close it, you have the sense that that character's life continues.
Yeah.
And that seems to me that that's an important difference. Now, how it is you create characters that seem to have a life of their own after the book ends, I don't know.
Well, I mean, when start in the beginning, you know, my method of working would make anybody fear that I'm going to end up with puppets on strings, who are just going to do what the author wants. And I think the process of writing is to interrogate the characters and their actions so deeply, you know, that in the end you really have made someone who would do those things for very deep and very wide reasons, you know. And I think that's how the characters are made, and that's a very slow process, you know, by questioning this and questioning that. And, you know, there's a little bell that rings, you know, an alarm bell, you know, when you're lying or not quite authentic, and you learn to listen to that. And in the end, there's a character.
We have a caller here. Let's give them a chance to talk with us, with you, in Urbana, here, line number one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Mm-hmm. Really privileged to talk to you. Just what David Ince was talking about, and you guys were just discussing, is the idea of when you create something. I've been in fine arts for a long time, and I had an advertising business for a while. But so it's kind of the dichotomy of, you know, intentional creation of of something versus, you know, sort of a subconscious creation like writing and painting. How far do your concerns go to when you finish the document or the book, and then you send it out in the public, and then you get feedback from critics? Does it bother you when someone completely misreads what you've written, or do you just think of it as just another interpretation of the document? It's a very interesting subject, because language is, in and of itself, is so generally subtle. It's not as black and white as everybody would like to say it is. But I was just curious if you could respond to that.
Well, yeah, I think all sorts of different things. You know, I mean, you know, when you think the book. The first stage for me is when I finish the book, and there's probably about 12 people who will read it. You know, people who've often read my work, some of them will be publishers and agents, and some will be a writer, and some will be an old friend. And at that moment, I'm getting a sense of whether I've done what I think that I've done. because it really, those readings are very, very important, and they matter to me. And at that stage, there are times then when somebody might say something that might make me alter just something to clarify something or do something like that. Not much, just little things.
I see. So you earlier said, basically when you were talking about your characters and how you develop them over a period of years, and then all of a sudden, so you're looking for, like, believability, and something like you were saying earlier about how, well, would that person, is that plausible or possible? Is that person, I mean, you think
I want people to do ridiculous things. I mean,
yeah.
I will, you know, I mean, Lasker and Lucinda, it's got to end up with these people, you know, floating a glass church on a barge down a river in the 19th century.
Yeah, so, can I ask you a question about the movie? When you're writing the book and then having someone, did you do the script on the movie or did?
No, I didn't. No.
Oh, so this is another example of what about this interpretation thing you and David were talking about. So you write this book, it becomes successful, then someone picks it up as an option to do a book. I mean, a movie. Mm-hmm. They do the script and then they make the movie, and then Ralph Fiennes was in it, I think. And did you think it was true to the book, or is it just another interpretation of the document, or is it more of a visual representation for film versus reading, that kind of thing?
Well, I think they are just such different things, and my first response to it all was just to think I had people who really loved the book, who really wanted to do it when their agents didn't want them to, and all that sort of thing. They did it because they loved it, and I think that's so. There's to make a film from a book. The first, you've got to break the book and you've got to rebuild it. And it will be something new, and you're nuts as a writer to think it can be the same thing, because it can't. Yeah. And then you get other things, the way the novel of Oscar and Lucinda works, you can have so many different ways of looking at Oscar. You can have a godlike sort of view, which is amused, or even ironic about him, and then you can have a very close, intense, passionate feeling what it's like to be Oscar inside. You can have other people looking at him and feeling affectionately about him and sympathetically, and others judgmentally, and others this. So you get all of these different points of view, which makes a very complicated Oscar. When you do it in the film, Rafe's got to carry the whole load of that.
Yeah.
And you're going to experience the film in a funny way sort of through his character. So it's impossible.
Yeah, you miss. Yeah, and I agree with that. I think it's interesting that I just find this whole translation thing, where even a reader, like when I read something from the 19th century, like Mark Twain, I mean, I'm reading it from a 20th century or 21st century perspective. So you look at it and you go like Huckleberry Finn or something. You're like, this is nuts. But then you realize. And I don't know, it's just, it's really, really a privilege to talk to you. And thanks a lot for your work. Really appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. We have maybe about 5 minutes left in this hour with Peter Carey. We're talking about writing and also about his newest novel. It's titled Theft, a Love Story, published by Knopf. It's just out. So you can find it in the bookstore. Also his other books, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. All of your stories they're very Australian. They're either set in Australia, they're about people from Australia, they're about people who still maintain a connection with Australia, even if they have a foot in some other places. And I know now you've been living in the United States for a few years now, and I have read that people apparently ask you, or have asked you, if you have ever thought about writing something about America, or whether characters were American, and that you said something like that you wouldn't or you couldn't, maybe because you feel like you just don't understand America well enough. Having said all that, do you think that there are some ways in which your writing has been, at least over the last, 10, 15 years or so, has been shaped by living in the United States and would be perhaps different than if you had still been living all that time in Australia?
Well, there's not, it must be different, but how is it different? That's the question. I mean, I think obviously my life, if I was living in Australia for the last 15 years, my life would have been different to living in New York for the last 15 years. I can't tell what it would have done to my work. I mean, I think there are benefits, accepting that I am preoccupied and interested in Australia, there are benefits in living away from it in that it looks stranger and stranger. And mind you, all day, I'm looking at you guys, I think you look pretty strange. and we look strange. And that's led to, many. See, the language in Theft, Butcher's language, is very, you know, he cusses an awful lot, and yet he has sort of quite elevated sort of aspirations and pursuits, you know, aesthetically and intellectually. And I was actually living in New York, and I'd notice, I mean, New Yorkers, educated New Yorkers, tend not to swear an awful lot. But I'd have some people to dinner, and they'd be, yeah, I'm a very distinguished Australian, say a geologist, you know. And suddenly the level of the mixture of high and low, of, you know, the profane and the elevated, was sometimes shocking to my New York friends. And I thought, you know, this is something about how we speak, and there's maybe an opportunity here to create, because I am, as you said at the very beginning, really interested in voice and the voices of characters. And so Butcher's voice, with, you know, it's very, you know, high level of profanity, but this is a voice of an artist as well, was very interesting for me to, and I think that's living away, you know, you mm-hmm. see this strangeness.
Yeah.
And that's a gift.
Well, and there, and speaking again about voice, I think in the voice of Hugh, and I think a number of reviewers have remarked on it, and I think it's true, it is particularly something about Hugh, even though I don't know that you'd actually want to live with him, and certainly Butcher thinks that it's a great, the responsibility of having to take care of Hugh, because as he says in the book, something like, you know, there always was Hugh, there always is Hugh. It's a responsibility that he can never get away from.
Yeah.
At the same time, that he has a, and there's this sort of seeming undercurrent of potential violence in Hugh. He also has this very gentle soul. He really has the soul of a poet, I think.
Mm. Well, Hugh was, you know, when I, you know, by the time the book's finished, I've discovered Hugh and Butcher's, the brothers' relationships, is one of the cores of the book. But he wasn't there at the very beginning. And I got to chapter 3, which is where Hugh appears, and thought I needed something.
Mm.
And someone who would be more, another voice, another way of looking at Butcher, that would question what he was saying, and also someone who Butcher would have to care for, because I thought that was important. And the voice just emerged, and I just sat down and started to write it, and I didn't fiddle with it, I didn't change it, and that first chapter is pretty much how I wrote it the first time.
Huh.
But even then I thought, well, God, that's all right, that's not bad, but what will I do with him? You know, maybe this is a trap to... And out of that, and continuing to write chapters for Hugh, I discovered one of the things the book now seems to be primarily about, if you can use such a word.
Well, that's, again, a nice example of how things... you may not necessarily have a plan or you have an idea, but that it develops and that characters may come and things that may go in a direction that you don't have that in mind when you start.
I didn't have Hugh in mind. I mean, I knew it was all Marlene was going to be there, and the end would be like it. Well, it is sort of like it is now, but there was no Hugh, and so and it's unimaginable now. And I'm very proud of Hugh, and I'm very proud of the voice, and it's impossible to think about the book without Hugh.
Yeah. Well, it is this wonderful sort of internal, poetic, internal stream of consciousness kind of dialogue. As I thought about it, that this wasn't something that Hugh would or even could speak out loud, that somehow he is talking to himself, and to himself.
It is, weirdly, isn't what we accept, you know, in the conventions of storytelling. You know, it is the voice of somebody telling their story.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, when I wrote True History of the Kelly Gang, it was very important to me that it actually be written down by the person telling the story, physically written.
And there it was inspired by a long sort of rambling letter that Ned Kelly himself left behind. And there, I guess, the part of the inspiration was you reading that and thinking, God, this is great.
Yeah.
This voice is great. How about let's tell an entire story and see if I can capture that and tell it as if Ned Kelly was telling us the entire story of his life and everything that happened to him.
Yes, and so then you have to sort of insist that he, the character, sits down and writes it. These two voices, you know, I think come out of a sort of a different tradition, you know, where they're the voices of storytellers. Mm-hmm. And I don't think for a second that either of them wrote it down. And nor do I think that they sort of spoke it aloud. So they're the magical voices that we have in literature that tell us a story.
Well, I'm sorry to say that we're going to have to stop, that we've used the time. I would like to, I wish I could keep going, but we can't. All I will say again is the book is Theft, A Love Story. It's brand new by Peter Carey. It's published by Knopf. It's out now, and all of his other novels are available. They're all available in paper, and I would recommend them all. And to you, Peter, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, David.